This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The market for low-alcohol and alcohol-free alternatives has spiked in recent years, but is anyone drinking less? Doctors are reporting a rise in alcoholic liver disease in women. Today, we're going to talk about how much alcohol consumption is too much and some of the alcohol alternatives out there, including adaptogens. Joining me now are University of Cincinnati Medical Director of Liver Transplant, Dr. Mick Shea. Thanks for being here, Dr. Shea.
Thank you.
George Washington Center for Integrative Medicine Medical Director, Dr. Misha Kogan. Welcome, Dr. Kogan.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Vox Media Senior Correspondent Rebecca Jennings. Thanks for being with us, Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Dr. Shea, who's drinking less these days? Is anyone drinking less these days?
That's a great question. Actually, the rate of increase in alcohol use disorder is increasing across all age groups. Historically, men have always drank more than women, and that continues to persist. But we're seeing younger people drink more, and particularly in women. Women are drinking at the same rate as men, which has changed over the last several years. This trend existed pre-pandemic, but we've really seen a significant increase in younger and more women with alcohol-related liver disease and alcohol use disorder.
So who, I mean, I don't know if you run into this with your patients, who's opting for these low alcohol and alcohol-free choices out there?
A lot of people talk about it, particularly younger patients talk about these alcohol alternatives. You have to be a little wary of them, particularly in patients with alcohol use disorder and alcohol-related liver disease, because some of these products still have small amounts of alcohol, less than 0.5%. And in addition, other products contain other unregulated substances, which could be harmful to your liver and your health as well.
Hmm. Rebecca, I know you wrote about this for Vox. What did you find?
So I found that a lot of young people are interested in purchasing items that like promise to do something, but aren't exactly alcohol. So you see these packaged goods that have adaptogens or nootropics and caffeine in them that, you know, are stylized really in these like really cool packages. Model Bella Hadid is one of the founders of one of these brands, Kin Euphorics. But we're also seeing, you know, over the course of the 2010s, there was more education on, you know, the fact that alcohol is kind of across the board really bad for you. And so a lot of things kind of popped up to ease that transition from alcohol to not alcohol. And I think you see a lot of people replacing it with weed, with shrooms, with kava, with kratom. And, you know, the drugs that young people are using at nightclubs are moving from alcohol and cocaine to ecstasy to more like hallucinogens like ketamine and DMT. And so there's this interest in, you know, they still want some kind of effect, but not necessarily the effect of alcohol.
Hmm. Dr. Kogan, as a geriatrician, do you have concerns about older people and their level of consumption of alcohol? Or are some older people drinking more than they even realize they should be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I we also know that during pandemic, there was a significant increase in alcohol use across all the ages, and that didn't spare older adults at all. And actually, we often see a kind of a silent problems with alcohol, especially in older men who wouldn't report that. And sometimes they wouldn't even report this after direct questioning. So definitely a big problem. And that's also a group of it's also a population that's not necessarily, as Rebecca said, exploring the alternatives at all. I mean, they're kind of left behind of this evolution or revolution, however you look at this, of the changes in the high, if you will, or in a buzz.
Dr. Kogan, are there any specific concerns about older people and the impact too much alcohol can have on them? I'm thinking about how it could, you know, interact with prescription medication, that sort of thing. Is that of particular concern maybe for older
adults?
That's
exactly right. I mean, I think it's one issue that's even more so specific to older adults, not just interactions with medications, but with all kinds of other things, with vitamins, with supplements, with herbs. And you know, again, if they're not disclosing that information to their treating team, then that's even a bigger problem, because then the treating team may not even realize what's happening and may keep prescribing liver, potentially liver toxic medications and increasing harm.
We're talking about the health risks associated with drinking alcohol and some of the alternatives to drinking that are out there. Do you have a question about how much drinking is safe or one of the low alcohol or alcohol-free products available? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Shea, what are the recommended allowances of alcohol for men and women?
That's a good question. It's different for men and women. Women metabolize alcohol slightly different, and they're just smaller in size. So for men, the healthy amount of alcohol is 2 drinks a day or about 14 drinks a week. And for women, it's 1 drink a day and roughly 7 drinks a week. It's important to define what is actually a drink as well, which we struggle with. But for all people, it's about 14 grams of alcohol, which equals about 12 ounces of kind of your standard beer, 5 ounces of wine, which is not the typical pour that we see, and about 1.5 fluid ounces of spirits.
Hmm. And Dr. Shea, you just mentioned that, you know, there are these different recommendations for men and women. It's not just about body size. Talk to us a bit more about the different ways bodies metabolize alcohol.
Yeah, so there's an enzyme within the stomach, and women have a lower expression of that enzyme, so they tend to have a higher oral bioavailability of alcohol, so just higher concentrations of alcohol in the blood than men as well. Mm. And then overall body size affects the overall distribution of alcohol. So that leads to women smaller size, higher concentrations of alcohol in the blood after ingestion.
Mm-hmm. But even if you're a very tall or a bigger woman, you're still metabolizing alcohol differently than if you were a man.
Correct.
Okay, interesting. You know, let me ask you this, Dr. Shea, is there any safe amount of alcohol to consume?
I think that's the ongoing debate currently. There was recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about the reduced risk of cancer with alcohol consumption. And actually, Ireland's coming out with warning labels for alcohol saying that this causes cancer. So there is significant debate within the community. Is there a healthy amount of alcohol, and what is that, or any alcohol? So the CDC is recommending that people who aren't drinking don't start drinking, and still up for reasonable discussion of what and when and how much alcohol you should drink in everyone. So overall, I think that question remains to be answered, but lower amounts of alcohol, or if you're not drinking at all, I would not recommend to start drinking.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kogan, what do you see in older patients? Is it, I know you said some older patients aren't disclosing, but do they tend to be drinking more than they did in their youth, or is there a lower amount that you should be consuming when you're older than you did when you were younger?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think there's a particular data that suggests that somehow with aging, the amount of alcohol to be consumed if you're doing it for questionable health benefit is different. Definitely more older adults should discontinue alcohol completely if they're on a particular types of medications or if they already have certain problems, like let's say they already have some liver abnormalities. Can I add something not related to older adults, though?
Sure.
It's more.
Yeah.
So there's this concept. There are certain societies in the world, right? What we call them blue zones. So this are the areas where people live exceptionally long. So they end up having much higher percentage of population making to age of 100. So centenarians. And turns out that some of these areas, the alcohol consumption has been historic and has been continuous for centuries. Sardinia is one, Italy and Icaria off of main island of Greece. I think that the part of the issue we never discuss is that the alcohol comes in a combination with a variety of other things. So it's not in an isolation. Usually those cultures consume local alcohol, raised there, they're cultivating the grapes, they're making it. It's rarely that they drink hard liquor. Usually it's some kind of a process of fermentation, which probably has some additional benefits for microbiome. And so it's much more sophisticated topic. I think when we look at this in isolation, we unfortunately cutting out, due to how we do research, we're cutting out some of this historic, cultural, traditional factors. And so with that in mind, I think it's important to understand that if the alcohol is more as a part of the culture, it may be okay in a moderation in a small amount.
Interesting. We did get a call from Kelly. Kelly says we need to talk about alcoholism. Alcoholism, Kelly says, is not solved by doctors. It's solved by AA. Dr. Shea, is that something you deal with in your practice? People who have or who are alcoholics, they have substance use disorder, they drink too much alcohol, they're addicted. How do you walk people through that problem?
We talk about their use, how much they're drinking, and how we can prevent them from drinking and connecting them to the resources that are available. Alcoholics Anonymous is one avenue. There's counseling, group counseling, individual counseling, and there's even medication therapy for people as well. So it's kind of integrating that conversation into your care of patients. Mm-hmm. And we deal with that every day, and that's becoming more and more part of our job description is dealing with patients with alcohol use disorder and then connecting them and treating them as well.
Yeah. Well, and I imagine different avenues work better for some patients than others. I know there are many people who've been very successful with Alcoholics Anonymous, other people who maybe haven't.
Sure, exactly. Alcoholics Anonymous is more of a faith-based avenue, whereas there's other non-faith-based avenues as well. We tailor it to each individual patient and what works for them.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, what is it that you have found in your reporting that really draws people to alcohol? That gets to this question of addiction and why some people can't stop, but why can't we as people seem to kind of get away from it, so many of us?
Yeah, I mean, one person I talked to who wrote a book about the history of vice in general said that, if you go back as far back as you go in human history, you'll see people drinking in groups. And that's also like, it's linked to the rise of all these social movements, even like the Enlightenment, like this happened in taverns. The feminist movement happened in women's living rooms where, you could sit around have a glass of wine. But I think ultimately, alcohol is fun. It makes things more bearable. There are no health benefits, but there are societal benefits. And one of them is that like, it can change how you think, it can change the experiences that you can have. And I think you will always see people looking for a respite from the anxiety of life. And if it's not alcohol, it could be something else. And that's why you're seeing this rise of all these products that kind of promise to make you feel like free and act as like a social lubricant and make you feel happy or chatty and make, weddings and work happy hours a little bit more bearable. And there will always be a market for that. But of course, what comes, anytime there's a kind of a mind altering substance that carries with it the risk of addiction and overuse and figuring out as people when and when not to indulge in certain vices is kind of like one of the struggles of being alive. So I think like this is, I don't know if we'll ever find a substance that is, has all the benefits of alcohol and none of the downsides, because such a substance would like, of course we would find a way to make that like destructive in some way if it was so perfect of a substance. You know what I mean?
Mm. Human nature, I guess. Dr. Shea, let's talk more, Rebecca was just talking about what draws people to alcohol. Let's talk more about the risk factors. You talked about a rising use of alcohol among women. I've read that alcoholic liver disease is spiking among women. Talk to us about that and also about breast cancer. What are the risk factors there?
So definitely increase in women drinking. That has occurred over the last 25 plus years. We've seen a change in kind of advertising to women. It's the so-called pinking of drinking, especially wine down Wednesdays, mommy juice, and other euphemisms that we now describing with women. So it is an important risk factor. And with women, particularly breast cancer, increased associations in breast cancer, other aerodigestive cancers such as esophageal cancer, oral pharyngeal cancer, larynx cancer, and liver cancer and colorectal cancer, all increased risk with alcohol use. And it's actually a dose-dependent effect. So the more they drink, the more you drink, the higher the risk of those particular cancers.
So does that mean alcohol is a carcinogen?
That is the way that we are moving. Just like smoking is a carcinogen, alcohol is now being considered a carcinogen. And actually, as I mentioned previously, Ireland in about 2 years, May of 2026, is going to label alcohol as a carcinogen on all alcoholic beverages.
Wow. So Dr. Shea, Dr. Kogan was just talking about these other communities where alcohol is part of the culture. It's wine that's grown in the region. It's fermented in the region. People live a long time in these regions. I guess I wonder, do the risk factors change based on people's overall health? If you're running marathons, if you're exercising every day, eating lots of leafy greens, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Patients who are healthy tend to have lower rates of alcohol-related liver disease. In particular, patients who are obese or have diabetes have higher rates of alcohol liver disease, and that's really related to those comorbid conditions that increase the risk. To Dr. Kogan's point about the type of alcohol you drink, in the United States, we've seen a rise in spirits rather than beer over the last 40 years. The thought is that these highly concentrated alcohols cause a spike in the alcohol concentration and therefore may cause more harm as well. In addition, there was a study out of the UK looking at when people drink, and basically, and the rates of cirrhosis or severe liver disease, and they found that women, particularly who drink outside of meals, have higher rates of cirrhosis compared to women that drink with meals. And the thought, and we don't know exactly why, but the thought or the hypothesis is that you're drinking outside of dinner, more likely to drink spirits, and with dinner, you're more likely to drink wine. In addition, when you drink with food, it lowers your absorption of alcohol as well. So that's an added benefit when people drink with meals.
Hmm. What about heart disease? Does the risk of heart disease go up with alcohol use also?
So there's some research, and it's conflicting research, talking about benefits of alcohol, at least light to moderate consumption of alcohol with cardiovascular disease, particularly coronary heart disease as well. In addition, that has not been shown to be as effect with other cardiovascular disease like stroke, etc. Right now, the data is kind of conflicting at this point. Mm-hmm. Cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. Dr. Kogan, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all of these points are really fascinatingly correct. I think a really important issue with heart disease, again, when you look at those healthy areas where people live long, it's not in isolation. We just don't know what alcohol adds in isolation. And I agree. I think there's just very conflicting data. In fact, I actually think there's more negative data than positive data on cardiovascular health. So definitely will not recommend that any of my older adults who've never had alcohol to start drinking all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And how do you isolate the components of effect when our biomedical research model tends to say, okay, we're going to look into the what's one particular effect, analyze that, and remove the rest. The issue is you can't really remove the rest, right? It's a whole... Patients live not in isolation. They live in the community. They have the diets, they have lifestyle, they have exercise, or they don't have exercise. And so all of these things together, that makes research very challenging, mm-hmm. the practical research.
Yeah. When we come back, we'll talk about some of these alcohol alternatives. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about alcohol, the health risks associated with drinking, and some of the low alcohol or alcohol-free alternatives on the market. My guests are University of Cincinnati Medical Director of Liver Transplant, Dr. Mick Shea, George Washington Center for Integrative Medicine Medical Director, Dr. Misha Kogan, and Vox Media Senior Correspondent, Rebecca Jennings. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.com. alcoholfreeprevention.org. Rebecca, the market for these low alcohol and alcohol-free alternatives has really exploded. Talk about some of these options that are available for consumers now. You mentioned a few of them before the break, but tell us a little bit more about those.
Yeah, for sure. So I think if you go back to like the beginning of the 2010s, really the only options if you walked into a bar or restaurant and you were sober were like a non-alcoholic beer, which maybe there was like one if you were lucky, or, you know, a club soda or a Diet Coke or something. But in the 2010s, there was this huge rise of low and no alcohol alternatives. One of the most famous ones is Athletic Brewing, which is, you know, the main non-alcoholic craft brewery. And it's actually the fastest growing company in the beer market right now. It debuted in 2017. And the same year, we got the canned water brand Liquid Death, which, you know, has this very ironic kind of heavy metal goth branding. But I think it allowed a lot of young people who were in spaces where there was a lot of drinking to feel like they were participating, even though they were only drinking like sparkling water. We also saw in that same time period a lot of zero proof spirits and alcohol free bars just completely skyrocketed. And it, like, you know, it was a place for people to, you know, feel like they were in a bar and could be in a social setting that, you know, didn't involve actual alcohol. And by, I think you see before the pandemic, there was, I wrote a trend piece in 2019. It was like the biggest trend in alcohol is drinking less. And one of the reasons why is, you know, the sober curious movement started by Ruby Warrington. And a lot of, like canned beverages that, you know, had low or no alcohol, it kind of felt like a juice or a seltzer. And a lot of the alcohol companies in turn sort of began marketing their products as like friendly with diets and like part of wellness culture, which is kind of crazy. But in the same decade, we get huge amounts of weed legalization. So a lot of people switching from alcohol to weed. There was a huge boom in shrooms research and psilocybin. And also kava bars and kratom became really, really widespread in that same time period as well. And all these things obviously, or some of them come with their own health risks. But in over the past decade and a half, I would say there's just been so many more options for sober people and sober curious people.
Yeah. And we'll get into some of those one by one. But one of the things, Dr. Shea, de-alcoholized wine seems to be having kind of a moment. Do you know what that is? What do they do to wine to...
I'm not exactly sure what they do to wine to take it out, but I still think that there's still some small amount of alcohol in wine, this de-alcoholized wine. So you just have to be careful with that. So in patients who don't have alcohol use disorder or alcohol-related liver disease, I think it's a decent alternative to drinking regular wine. So as a physician, I think I'm glad that they're just not drinking as much. So whatever avenue we can utilize to help people drink less is important.
Okay. Rebecca, you mentioned, you know, these all these different beverages, and my understanding is non-alcoholic beer has come a long way from the old O'Doul's days. Are those non-alcoholic beer products something beer lovers can really enjoy?
Totally. I think Athletic Brewing is really the prime example of that. They've gotten, you know, really great scores from craft beer lovers. I think they're a really hot brand right now. And if you've tasted it, it really does taste like, you know, like an IPA, which often is the kind of beer with the most amount of alcohol. And they really kind of have been able to mimic that flavor that people, that craft beer drinkers really, really love. Mm. So yeah, these products are just getting better and better in terms of like them tasting more like alcohol. And as I think we've talked about a little bit, you know, a lot of times this is a bit controversial in sobriety spaces, because for a long time they were looked upon as like too close to home. Like, you know, you need a clean break from any type of alcohol culture in general, but ideas about sobriety are also shifting in the same time period. So, you know, there's more of a blurry line between sobriety and not, or the fact that sobriety needs to be a one size fits all. And I know that's like, that was once a very controversial thing to say. And now it's becoming more and more part of people's, you know, kind of health journeys, I guess.
Yeah. Dr. Shea, what do you think? I mean, what do you talk to patients about who have struggled maybe with alcohol in the past? Do you think the non-alcoholic beer is safe for those patients?
So in my patients with alcohol-related liver disease, we really try to push patients away from those options because they do contain some alcohol in them, and even a small amount of alcohol is harmful to the liver in those situations. In addition, these alcohol or alcohol-free alternatives sometimes provide the same cues that alcohol would provide, such as, you know, it has the same taste, it has the same look, even as Rebecca was saying, sometimes from the same brand. So it's a little bit of a slippery slope in those patients. In my line of work, we tend to avoid non-alcoholic beverages. In terms of patients with alcohol use disorder, I agree with Rebecca. The thought is evolving. The field is evolving, and she's right. There's not one size fits all for sobriety.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kogan, there's this other market called adaptogens that people are turning to as an alternative to alcohol, but also use them to relieve anxiety and for overall wellness. What are adaptogens?
Yeah, so they're not actually an alternative to alcohol at all. People use them for all kinds of reasons. You mentioned one, anxiety is one. So adaptogens are... most of the time they're botanicals, so they are plants. Sometimes they're mushrooms. Mushrooms are actually in their own category. Those are the plants or those are the botanicals that tend to help us to deal with the stress. So somehow they're naturally allowing our adrenal system to function a little bit better. And by doing that, whenever the stressful situation arises, we can tolerate it better. And there is actually a good amount of evidence for certain healthcare-related conditions, and there's nothing really wrong for people to try to take lower potency of these products when they're managing, let's say, anxiety or some sleep difficulty, particularly falling asleep difficulty.
Hmm. What's in these products? I'm going to ask you about a few of them. Talk about mushroom coffee. What's in mushroom coffee, Dr. Kogan?
Yeah, so this is where I'm going to get very critical on all those products, because the reality is often you don't even know what's in there. I have looked at some of these products, and I don't think I want to mention any brands. I'm not a consumer expert. But usually they would list a good products. So maybe some of those mushrooms you may have heard, maitake, shiitake, cordyceps, reishi. But you don't know how much of the mushrooms in there. And the company is often claiming that they're kind of a substitute for coffee, that you're not going to get the sort of a caffeine withdrawal, or you're not going to get the negatives of the coffee, but you're going to get all the positives. And, you know, there may be some partial truth to it. A lot of the times people do feel to drink coffee in the morning because they want to get more energy. They want to get going around their day. And some of the mushrooms actually do that. For example, lion's mane, which is a very well-known mushroom in the East, in China and Japan, has been documented to be effective for cognitive boosting. In fact, in some of the parts of the Asia, it's often used in combination with medications, even to treat Alzheimer's disease. And the studies are pretty decent. Of course, the problem is when you're looking at somebody consuming this as a food or as a drink, the amounts that they're getting is usually very small. Often the claims are exuberant, and moreover, the claims are often, you know, they're fitting studies, but that's not the product that the people are consuming. You know, the studies are often done on a pharmaceutical grade extracts, which are not even available most of the time in this country.
What about kava? What's kava?
Yeah, kava is an herb. So kava is an herb that's has kind of a two fames. So one is bad, one is good. Let's start with the bad. Some years ago, maybe more like decade plus, kava was contaminated. And so there was some really serious liver toxicity from the kava. And after that, there was a period of time where kava was, I think, almost completely unavailable or only very limitedly available. But kava is in a small amounts and a high quality products is a pretty decent anti-anxiety support. I mean, it's not as strong as some medications, but some patients really like it. And also it often does not have side effects of medication. So kava that is taken carefully in the right amount of a high quality brand will not give you kind of this aftermath of medications.
What about, Rebecca mentioned kava bars, you know, that there are these kava bars. I don't know that there are any in Cincinnati. I'm not really one of the hip kids, so I don't know. But
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But
didn't want to tell you.
Yeah. do you have any sense for whether they use this high quality kava that you were referencing that can be helpful?
I'd be surprised if they do. You know, we tend to work with the products that are sold like more closer to pharmaceuticals, where it's only distributed through physicians' offices. You have a label, you know exactly what's on the label that's in the bottle, that each batch is typically tested by the third party independent company. I really, really seriously doubt when people go to any bars that they get anything remotely similar to products like this. So probably they're getting a pretty, much lower quality products, but maybe some bars do have a high quality. I don't know. Rebecca may know more. Sounds like she's been researching the actual realities of what's happening out there.
Do you know how high quality the kava is at these kava bars, Rebecca?
Well, so yeah, so a lot of people that I spoke to in the kava world say that like this substance is basically like not regulated well, and so it's pretty much up to the industry itself to regulate itself. And that's where you get a lot of, you know, people doing too much or whatever, not enough or not high quality. And there are these cases of people getting really, really sick because there aren't enough studies being done. And, you know, there just isn't enough regulation on what's in each, like people that order it online, they don't really know what they're getting, as is the case with a lot of supplements. So kava is not well regulated. And so, yeah, there's really no way to tell what you're actually getting and whether what people say they're giving you is actually what they're giving you.
Yeah. We just got a call from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, but wanted to know if there are groups in Cincinnati for people who want to be sober. He wasn't interested in AA. Our producers suggested maybe searching social media for sober curious groups in Cincinnati. Are there any particular places you point people, Dr. Shea, when they ask you about that? I don't know if your practice has suggestions.
In terms of sober groups, not necessarily. I'm not familiar with any in the area, but for people that are not interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's other pathways, including Smart Rehab and others that are available in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And those resources are available online.
Yeah. Rebecca, do you find that social media is a way to kind of search for maybe sober curious groups in different communities? I don't expect you to know the rundown in Cincinnati, but is that what you would start with if you were looking for kind of social groups for people who don't want to drink?
Oh, 100%. I think the first place I would go is Facebook groups, because that's been such a great resource for any kind of local social meetup group that you could possibly imagine. Like there's really no, like few other places, maybe like subreddits, like local specific subreddits could be interesting. But I think Facebook is a really good first stop. And also going to like, if you guys have like an alt weekly or something. But yeah, I find that the same place that you would get like into like your local Buy Nothing group, you could also find your local Sober Curious group or sober group.
Okay. Dr. Kogan, I want to ask you about one more of these substances. Rebecca mentioned kratom. I've also seen it called kratom. What is that? And is it addictive?
Yeah, so that's a hallucinogenic item. Well, actually, you know, it's not truly hallucinogenic. So if you look at the sort of strict criteria of what hallucinogens are, kratom is not one of them, although some people claim that they get some kind of high. I've seen kratom used a couple of times in the clinic. Patients were trying to substitute narcotics. So they would try, they'd be in chronic pain and they would use it instead. Recreationally, I don't actually fully know what people use it for, but I would, you know, it is completely available everywhere. So people buy it without any, to my understanding, there's no regulation. And I think at the high doses, you can get quite a significant mind-altering states and potentially quite a lot of toxicity, because there is some partial effect on an opioid system. So you can theoretically get really, really sick from it. Mm-hmm. But I think clinicians have very little limited experience with it because it has not been legalized in any formal way. We can't recommend it for any particular condition, and our experience is very limited. So the only couple of cases I've seen, and that's in contrast with Rebecca was talking about psilocybin, the kind of common name shrooms or magic mushrooms. That we're seeing a lot more uptick in the, everywhere in the country, but also things like ketamine, which is prescribed medication that's used recreationally as well, and of course cannabis.
Yeah. Well, I know there are several states across the country have banned kratom or kratom, however you want to say it. And I know that the Governor DeWine in Ohio has been looking closely at that. Well, we are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking today about alcohol, de-alcoholized wine, adaptogens, and everything in between. My guests are University of Cincinnati Medical Director of Liver Transplant, Dr. Mick Shea, George Washington Center for Integrative Medicine Medical Director, Dr. Misha Kogan, and Vox Media Senior Correspondent, Rebecca Jennings. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Kogan, I wanted to ask you about another one of these alternatives. A product called Apothecary has become popular as an alternative to wine, and it's supposed to help you sleep. Do you know much about that?
Not at all, but I'm going to Google it because every time I hear a new product, that's what we do nowadays. So is that a drink?
I believe it is a drink. Rebecca, are you familiar with Apothecary? I can't remember if that's one of the products you wrote about or not.
It's not, but it's definitely part of this this part of movement to replace alcohol with something that's healthy, but will also kind of get you relaxed. So it sounds very interesting to me and sounds like something that a lot of people probably want.
So you want my... Because I get these questions in the clinical practice at least once a day, maybe two or three times a day. So I get patients bringing new company to me and saying, well, what about this? My neighbor took this and now they cured of 25 illnesses and it's a miracle drug and it's free shipping. So I better get it now, right?
Oh.
So that's the usual thing we get. So just quick look, it looks like it's a very concentrated mix of adaptogens that they call it wine down, wine with W-I-N-E.
Mm.
So it looks like they're claiming that they're replacement for the wine or red wine alternative. And it looks like a concentrated red wine in like a little dropper. And so the ingredients are lots of different adaptogens. It's kind of hard to say what the concentration would be because, again, quite often what I find in this companies is news, they often would call it a proprietary blend. And so when I try to advise my patients, when I look at this, it wouldn't tell me how much a particular adaptogens would be.
Hmm.
So it makes it very difficult from clinical perspective to say, well, what would the benefit be? So like they would just say, okay, here are ingredients, artichoke leaf, dandelion, burdock root, gentian root, calendula, coriander seeds, turmeric, and ginger. Great ingredients, nothing really concerning. So this is, they call it never been bitter. It's a gut digestive support. But how much of all these things are in there? Are there other additives that they're not listing? You know, because the label does not have any of this. It just says there is a proprietary mix. So it left up to the consumer to decide, is it safe? Is it worth it? And it's not easy for us clinicians to really give any particular advices for something like this.
Mm-hmm. Do these products, Dr. Kogan, in your experience, do they live up to the claims they make?
You know, I think that's where we have to start talking about placebo, because I find that probably more than half of the times when patients coming in there, oh my God, this is the miracle product. And then I would, have some other people tested and they're like, I don't feel anything. So a lot of the times there's a massive placebo effect from all of these products. And also, you read reviews, you read some of the claims, you don't know who left those reviews. I think there is definitely a massive amount of marketing happening. I had patients claim that some of these products were very helpful, not this particular one, not the Apothecary. I've never seen this one before. Doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that it's new and I haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm. We did get a call from David. David says adaptogens have been around for decades, and these companies are clear about the dosage and that they are safe. Dr. Kogan, what do you think about that?
Okay, so adaptogens have been around for entire human evolution, not for tens of years. Adaptogens have been with us as far as we can tell. The first mentioning of adaptogens goes to a foundation of Chinese medicine over than 5,000 years ago, so way predates our modern medicine. So it's true that they've been very long time ago. It's also true that in the right amounts, with the right dosing, they're extremely safe. They would be incomparably safer than pretty much everything else we'll do. I'll say they're a lot safer than Tylenol by a mile. The problem is that statement of disclosure in the right amounts with the right guidance in the right application. To say that they're all safe and they're all fine out there would be completely wrong. That's not what the research shows. Research shows that, you know, we have thousands and thousands of different products out there, and most of them do not have what says on the label. Office of Garment Accountability some years ago did a wonderful study when they analyzed a whole bunch of different products and found that something in the scope of 60% to 70% of all the supplements out there do not have what's on the label. They may have less, they may not have at all, or they may have some other ingredients. And so I would never make such a broad claim. Now, that's not to say that there are really good players out there. There's some companies that produce wonderful products. They work predictably. They quite exactly what's on the label. The question that I always pose to a consumer is, how do you know which one? So if you went and you consulted with knowledgeable practitioner, that's wonderful. But if you did your own research, are you sure that you did the right research? Are you sure that you were able to bypass all the typical commercial sale pitch and gotten to the actual evidence and the research on particular products? And the reality is most people out there are really not able to do that, because it's not so easy to do so, to bypass all the sort of safeguards that the companies put around their data, because most of them, they don't have any data. They're not the data that was being, the studies that are done on products, usually not the products that are sold.
Yeah,
it's a similar product, but not exactly the product that you're buying.
Dr. Shea, all these different alternatives that we've been talking about, what about if you're pregnant or breastfeeding? Do you have different advice for patients who, you know, are dealing with that?
You have to be a little bit more cautious with pregnancy and consulting with your OB about whether this is safe or not, and particularly for breastfeeding, because a lot of these medications are excreted in breast milk. We talk about it with alcohol as well. Alcohol is safe to drink when you're breastfeeding, as long as you allow enough time prior to breastfeeding as well. So it's an important conversation to have with your physician if you're considering trying one of these new medications. But important to remember that no alcohol is safe in pregnancy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tony emails, we've heard that marijuana is possibly being taken off the Schedule 1 rating. What's the schedule classification for alcohol and chocolate? Well, I'm kidding about the chocolate, but not about the alcohol. Just really wondering, is that on the schedule at all anywhere, Dr. Shea, that you're aware of?
It's not on the schedule. And that's kind of one of the main issues with alcohol. It's kind of the hidden in plain sight with what we see with every day in our culture.
Yeah. Rebecca, what do you think about this wide variety of options now available for people who want to stop drinking alcohol or cut back on how much they drink? What is your overall thought about what's out there for folks now?
I mean, my thought is that I think anything that makes the world a more inclusive place for people that don't want to drink for whatever reason, whether they're sober, super curious, or just trying to drink less, which I think is so many young people right now, I think that's great. I also think that as Dr. Kogan was saying, there's a lot of really smart marketing going on with not a lot of clarity on what you're actually putting in your body. So ironically, like, you know, even if you're trying to make a healthy choice or a healthier choice, you still don't really know what you're getting. And to me, it's like, I mean, at some point, I'd rather just go for like a club soda. Like, you know what's in that. It's sparkling water. But I do think there's this desire to replace the ritual. And And again, as we know, alcohol is obviously terrible for you. But so anything that, you know, makes you drink less of it, I think that's probably a good thing. But as a drinker myself, I'm sometimes just like, it's the devil, you know, like, I'll keep my glass of wine.
Yeah. Dr. Shea, do you want to weigh in on that? What, there are all these alternatives out there, or are there any, you know, final warnings or, you know, words of wisdom you'd want to share with folks?
Just remember, drinking less in general is better for your health. And I think if you're exploring alternatives, that's a good sign. Just remember, some of these alternatives, as been previously stated, we don't know what they contain. They're not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and you just have to be cautious with those. So if you have underlying medical conditions, consult with your doctor before trying any of these alternatives. What we should be talking about with alcohol alternatives is talking about how these are studied in the future and whether the effect of them is actually reducing alcohol intake, which is still questionable at the current moment.
Yeah, you're still seeing a lot of people who drink an awful lot, right?
Tons and tons. It has leveled off since the pandemic, but it's still at a higher level than pre-pandemic.
Yeah. Dr. Kogan, any last words of wisdom you'd like to share in the 40 seconds we have left?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the whoever asked about the cannabis reschedule, that is correct. I think cannabis does have some future, especially as we will have a lot more research on it soon. So we'll have more. And I definitely would highlight, Dr. Shea said, is that definitely find a good provider who can guide you, because this topic is not that simple, way more complex than people think. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a physician. There is nutritionists, there's naturopathic doctors, there's a variety of providers who can guide you effectively.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Medical Director of Liver Transplant, Dr. Mick Shea, George Washington Center for Integrative Medicine Medical Director, Dr. Misha Kogan, and Vox Media Senior Correspondent, Rebecca Jennings. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. And if you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.